He helped repair the Hubble Space Telescope in orbit, not once, but twice. He sent the first tweet from space, and he's a guest star on CBS's The Big Bang Theory. His new book, Spaceman, is one of the best astronaut biographies I've ever read, and I've read a lot of them. We talked to former NASA astronaut Mike Massimino next on Blue Dot. Our guest is Mike Massimino. He's the veteran of two space shuttle missions, STS-109 on Columbia in March of 2002 and STS-125 aboard Atlantis in May of 2009. Both were missions to service the Hubble Space Telescope, and the final flight was the one that literally saved the Hubble so that it could make dramatic discoveries about the mysterious existence of dark energy and determine the age of the universe itself. His memoir, Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe, is out in print and on Audible. Mike Massimino, welcome to Blue Dot.
Dave, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
You begin the story with the trip out to the pad and the launch of Columbia on STS-109. What's really striking about that account is you're really candid about the aspect of fear. Could you tell us a bit about how you wanted to start the story that way?
You know, for me, as you learn in the book further on, at the beginning of the book, after the prologue, we talk about me growing up in Long Island, and I was not what you would consider to be a fearless candidate to be a test pilot or astronaut like John Glenn and Neil Armstrong and my other heroes back when I was a little boy. To me, this was all new. This idea of doing something that dangerous was all new to me. But it was really extraordinary as well. And so we get right into it. And I very honestly, in the book, just like I've been telling that story when I talk to people of what it was like, and it was pretty intimidating. And people ask me if I was scared, and yes, I certainly was. And it hit me more or less on launch morning. You know, I thought about leading up to launch, I thought about it and what might happen and so on. But it really hit me that morning getting out to the launch pad, looking at the shuttle all fueled and ready to go. It really kind of set in that maybe this wasn't the smartest thing to be doing that day.
I have a little bit of trepidation about interviewing you because you're at the end of a long book tour, and I'm sure you get asked the same questions over and over. But that reminds me of a just really lovely moment in your story where you met Neil Armstrong. His life has been, it was in a way circumscribed by his historic role as the first man on the moon, but he handled it with such grace, and you really share that. Could you tell us briefly about that story?
He was a very shy individual. He was not, a big, gregarious person, but very, very polite, very graceful, sort of elegant. You just give him respect. He just didn't act cocky or arrogant at all. Wasn't about him at all. He just seemed to be a very sincere and grateful, humble person who just loved to fly airplanes and learned to fly airplanes at a very young age and then became a military pilot and a test pilot and a great test pilot and then eventually a great astronaut. And everyone that knew him, the stories you hear about him were the same, that he was just a terrific pilot who loved flying, and that was his whole life. And when we got to meet him, he was very, very gracious and agreed to sign autographs for my astronaut class, and came and said hi to us. This is our first week at work. So our first week at work, we get to meet Neil Armstrong, my entire astronaut class. And it was just wonderful getting a chance to meet him and see how humble and truly what a great man he was.
You grew up in the 1960s, obviously, and you explained that the astronauts back then were held in such high esteem, the Apollo astronauts, the Gemini astronauts, the Mercury astronauts. It's hard for people nowadays to have a sense of that adulation. What was it about them that made them so special to everyone at the time?
I think one is that they were doing something on behalf of the country that everyone saw as a thing that was very American at that time. Kind of like the greatest American hero that you can imagine. They were doing something that was very dangerous, that took a lot of courage to do, that not everyone would do. It was seen as something that was very dangerous, and it was, but these guys were willing to do it. And it also had a certain skill associated with it. I mean, we applaud talented entertainers or athletes for what their skill is and what they're able to do. And I think that that same type of skill and talent that went into these astronauts, the abilities they had, their flying abilities, their intellect, the skill that they had to make them astronauts, I think everyone admired. And then when you add that to the willingness to take the risk to do something for the public good, and to do something that at the time was so important to America and such a sign of what the times were and what the future held, these guys were the ultimate rock stars. You know, they were like really smart rock stars. Not that rock stars aren't smart, but you know, these were guys who had embodied, I think, everything that people held as important and admirable. That's what those guys embodied.
As you were growing up in Long Island, it probably didn't seem possible to become somebody like them, and yet you did. How did that evolve, and how did you go from a boyhood dream where you had your little Snoopy astronaut doll to a guy who's going to apply to NASA to become an astronaut?
Yeah, the dream kind of, right, you know, I talk about this in a book, of course, but the dream kind of died on me because I realized that I wasn't a fearless test pilot. I would never be one of those guys. I think it just seemed like impossible. And in my neighborhood, I didn't see anybody growing up to be astronauts. And I remember I did have one baseball coach that worked for Grumman. Mr. Draghi was my baseball coach when I was in elementary school, and I remember he worked for Grumman as an engineer. But there really wasn't much going on with the space program as I was going up on that I knew about on Long Island. Not that there wasn't, but it just didn't seem to enter into my consciousness out in Long Island and where I grew up. And you know, it just seemed like doing stuff like that was for other people, not from anybody from my neighborhood. And it just seemed impossible. And I was an awkward kid who couldn't see very well and was afraid of heights. You know, I'm still afraid of heights. How was I ever gonna do this? How was I ever gonna make this happen? So I just thought it just could not happen. I just thought this was totally impossible, would never happen. And kind of gave up on it. And it wasn't until after I got out of college and started to learn a little bit more about what the astronauts were like, that they weren't the just test pilots anymore. You know, I started getting interested again in the space program, and it was spurred on by going to see the movie The Right Stuff, which was about the original seven astronauts. I saw that movie in 1984, just as I was about to graduate from college, and it started my interest up again of how cool I thought those guys were. But then I learned that the real astronauts at that time, the shuttle astronauts in the mid-80s, now were different. They were women, and they were still military test pilots, but now you had the first women and people of color, and they were not only military test pilots, but also engineers and scientists and medical doctors and people with PhDs and people who were maybe more like me, who had an interest in flying in space, but they weren't military test pilots. So I thought that maybe there might be a chance. And I think that was the first time I started thinking, maybe I can get the credentials I need and the experience I need, and maybe I can apply, and maybe I can do it. Unlikely. It probably was never going to happen, but I thought maybe it could.
Well, you refer to those military test pilots, and in the book you talk about one of your favorite movies, which is, I think, my favorite movie, and that's The Right Stuff. It's just an amazing movie. How did that 1983 film resonate with you then and now?
It captured a few things for me. One is the camaraderie between the astronauts, that they were doing something that was really important. They weren't doing it for the money. They were doing it because it was important, and they thought it was cool, and they were having a blast doing it. And the way they stuck up for each other, the way they got along, doing it together as a team. I wanted that badly. I wanted to be a part of an organization like that. And then also what got me were the scenes of John Glenn orbiting the Earth and then looking out at the beautiful scene of the Earth around him and how what that looked like. And I wanted to get that view. But I didn't just want to get that view. I wanted to be part of the team. And that's why, you know, for me, you know, if someone just offered me one shot to fly in space, you know, for like a holiday or a vacation as a visitor, as some people have done, of course I would have done it. But what I really wanted to do is I wanted to be part of that team. I wanted to be a NASA astronaut. I wanted to be one of those guys. I wanted to be one part of that team. And the right stuff rekindled that interest that I had. It stirred my soul, so to speak, and got me thinking about it again. Remember how much you loved this when you were a kid. You know, this is what really got you excited when you were a kid, and it got me. And that movie got me excited about it as an adult.
You faced a lot of adversity on your path to becoming an astronaut, and overcoming those obstacles is, I think, one of the best things about this book, something that we can all take some, you know, lessons from. Could you share one of those obstacles with us?
My path to becoming an astronaut?
Yes.
Yeah, there was a lot of them. For me, probably the most significant one, I think, ended up being my poor eyesight, and there wasn't many options that were available to me. I was medically disqualified when I interviewed. I applied twice and got rejected outright, and then I applied a third time, and was medically disqualified, which was kind of a real wall. I mean, it didn't matter who you were at that point; they couldn't accept you. It just was like no. You're medically unfit, and it didn't matter if I went on to win a Nobel Prize. It didn't matter who I was. It is just I couldn't. Not that a Nobel Prize would help me become an astronaut, but it didn't matter what I achieved from that point on. I could never be an astronaut, and it was really disheartening because there was no recourse for it as well at the time. No, now it's not an issue. They've changed the vision requirements and. If anyone's listening and wants to apply and is concerned about their vision, they should look online and see what the requirements are, because they do change. But more recently, they changed it where they could accept LASIK, for example, to improve your eyesight. They didn't accept that back then. And so I had nothing I could do, I thought. And I just realized that what I had to do was I had to figure out a way to see better. And went through some vision training and was able to improve my vision. And for me, that was probably the biggest obstacle because... You know, I had failed the exams at school, and I had some tough semesters here and there, and I had some setbacks in my research, and things not working out the way I wanted, and disappointments. But they seemed like those were things that had happened to people before that you could overcome. And being medically disqualified, I saw as just something that would never be pushed to the side. But after dwelling on it for a couple of days, I thought, well, why not? And even if I could overturn, and I knew there was still very little chance I'd become an astronaut anyway, because I still had to get accepted based on everything else. But I had to overcome that the vision hurdle, and I was able to.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with former astronaut Mike Massimino. And we're back on Blue Dot talking to Mike Massimino about his new book, Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. A lot of people, I imagine, want to ask you, what's it like to be in space? You describe what it looked like and felt like being in space quite vividly. I was especially struck by your descriptions of the lighting. How different do things look when you're up in orbit?
It's like seeing clearly for the first time, I felt. Being up there and being out, especially during the spacewalk, and the lighting in space is very, very bright. The light coming in the window, direct sunlight, and very, very dark when you're over the dark part of the Earth when you're over in sunset. But when you get outside in a spacewalk, the light is not being filtered even by a window. It's just right there in your visor. What we see on Earth is we have light being filtered through our atmosphere, which is distorted and filtered, and it doesn't seem the same as it does in space. And especially when you get outside and you don't have any filtering through a window at all, and you don't have any framing of the view in a window, you can look at what you want. It is just so bright. It's the brightest white. It's not even like light. It's like just whiteness, pure whiteness, is what the sun is like during a spacewalk. And then when you get into the darkness, as you go away from light, as you go away from the sun, you just turn away from the sun in your orbit, and you're over the part of the Earth where it's nighttime. It's like the absence of light. It's like all that pure light, all that pure whiteness is now gone. It's a void, completely gone, from pure white to the exact opposite.
You're listening to Blue Dot, and we're talking to Mike Massimino about his new memoir, Spaceman, An Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. It's out in print and on Audible. You were also privileged to see a view of the Earth from Hubble's orbit. Can you explain to us how that's different from, say, the view aboard the International Space Station?
The International Space Station flies at about 250 statute miles above the Earth. Hubble is up at 350 miles. They wanted Hubble to get as far away from the planet as possible. And being launched on the shuttle, that's as far as you could get it, was about 350 miles up. But because of that, you get a slightly different view. You get to see more of the curvature of the Earth. You don't get to see as much detail when you're up at that altitude, but you get to see it more as a planet, more of the curve of the planet as a big, gigantic, round ball in front of you as you're going around it. It gave me this sensation of seeing the Earth as a planet, seeing that roundness gave me a different perspective. We were also down at lower altitudes before we went up to Hubble, and then after we lowered our altitude after the telescope was deployed, after we spacewalked on it, and it was a different scene. You can see more detail, but being up there at that higher altitude, especially during a spacewalk, I thought was extraordinary.
We're going to be airing this on Veterans Day, and of course, we've lost astronauts from the earliest days of the space program, many of whom are buried at Arlington National Cemetery. The loss of Space Shuttle Columbia is one of the most heartbreaking accounts in your book, and it was really a twist of fate that kept your crew from being on that flight. Would you please share with us your role in the mission and its aftermath?
Yeah, The twist of fate you're talking about kind of hit me about 2 days after the accident. The flight we lost was STS-107. The flight I was on was 109, and they assigned flights generally in numerical order. So 107 was going to go before 109, my flight, and we both were going to fly on Columbia. Space Shuttle Columbia came back from an overhaul out in California at Palmdale at. Where we would send the shuttles to get refurbished every few years, and when it came back to the Kennedy Space Center, there was something wrong. It was a problem with the paint, some strange thing that was done out in California. Didn't quite make it the way it was supposed to when it arrived in Florida, and they needed to do some extra work on Columbia as part of the refurbishment. And as a result, it was going to delay the launches, both 107 and 109. And they were concerned about moving ours more than they were about moving the 107 flight, which was a Space Lab flight, our flight going to Hubble, they didn't want to delay that because you want to get to Hubble and get there in time so things don't start to break on it that could risk the telescope's health. So they wanted to get our flight. They didn't want to delay our flight that much. So they decided to swap our flights. So we got their spot, and they got our spot, and we ended up coming back, and then they didn't. And that hit me a couple days after the accident. I was just thinking about that, and I realized, holy cow, that we, you know, we got swapped in the flight order, and my friends were killed. They didn't get a chance to come home.
Let's shift gears to happier things.
Yeah.
You also brought something pretty cool up with you as something to fly on the shuttle mission, and that has to do with your love of baseball.
Yes. I'm a huge baseball fan, so I think you're referring to my home plate. Is that
yes.
what you're referring to? My home plate. Really, I belong to the New York Mets. I'm a big baseball fan, and the Mets have been my team. And the Mets won the World Series in 1969, which was probably a greater miracle than Neil Armstrong walking on the moon. But those two things, man on the moon and Mets winning World Series and living and growing up in Long Island, which is Mets territory, those two big events just took hold of me as a little child and never went away. Still, my two biggest passions are baseball and the space program. So getting a chance to fly in space was a way for me to not only fly in space for the space program, but also do something to honor my baseball team. A friend of mine, Garrett Reisman, who's an astronaut from New Jersey, was a Yankees fan. In Yankee Stadium and Shea Stadium, where the Mets played at Shea Stadium, Yankees were Yankee Stadium, of course. Well, those two stadiums were going to have their last seasons in 2008 and be torn down for new stadiums that were being built to open in 2009. And Garrett was flying dirt from the pitcher's mound from Yankee Stadium. And I called up my friends at the Mets, and I had flown a jersey for the Mets on my first flight, STS-109, years earlier, and remained in close contact with a lot of friends at the Mets, and called up my friend Jay Horowitz, who's the vice president for media relations and the public affairs guy, and I called him up and said, "Hey, Jay, do you hear about this guy flying dirt in space?" And he goes, "Yeah, Mike, we heard about that guy flying dirt. We can do better than dirt. How about a home plate?" I was like, "All right, let's see if we can make it happen." And so he sent along a plate. We figured out a way to get it on board, and I got to fly the home plate and then return it to the Mets after the flight.
And throw out the first pitch.
Yeah, I've had a chance to throw out a few of those in a few different cities. And I would have to say the highlight for me was throwing one out after my first flight at Shea Stadium, and then going back again to the new field, Citi Field, and handing over the home plate, delivering it back to the Mets. So it was a great way to combine my two passions.
The final repair mission of the Hubble Space Telescope was one of NASA's most epic achievements. I remember watching it thinking, this reminds me of the Apollo missions. This is how big this is. And I was just riveted through the whole thing. Now that you've been involved in two repair missions, especially that one, what does Hubble mean to you now that you've been involved with it so deeply?
You know what's interesting is that a lot of the interviews I do now are more on things that Hubble finds. And what I see in the paper is, you know, now we fixed the telescope, it was a great mission. Now we're able to use Hubble and enjoy what it's showing us. And I think, you know, the title of my book is, you know, Spaceman, an Astronaut's Unlikely Journey to Unlock the Secrets of the Universe. And the Unlock the Secrets of the Universe comes from Hubble. Hubble is what unlocks the secrets of the universe. It is an amazing instrument, I think the greatest scientific instrument ever built, and to be a part of that team was just a real privilege. And to see the discoveries it's still coming up with, I talk about a repair that we did on an instrument called the Space Telescope Imaging Spectrograph in detail in the book, and it was the most complicated spacewalk repair we ever attempted, and had some troubles and struggles and so on. I described that drama in the book, but just a couple weeks ago, STS was responsible for discovering evidence of water on Europa, the moon of Jupiter. And more recently, Hubble discovered that there's 10 times as many galaxies in the universe than we thought previously. I mean, this is amazing that Hubble is coming up with these discoveries. It is bringing us answers to questions that we didn't even know to ask, showing us the beauty of the universe so everyone can appreciate it, and trying to give us answers to the big questions of how do we get here, who are we, is there anyone else out there? It's a magnificent instrument, and I think the beauty of the universe should not be discounted. It is showing us just how wonderful and how beautiful it is. Places we can only dream about going to, Hubble can show us. And I just am so happy that I had a chance to contribute in a small way to its success.
Well, we're running short on time, but I would encourage our listeners to read your book or listen to it even better. And because the story of repairing it is epic and riveting all the way through. But before we leave, I'd like to know, now that your NASA career is over as an astronaut, what are you doing to keep yourself engaged and happy and moving forward with the adventure of being Mike Massimino?
Well, talking to you guys is one, trying to spread the word, share the experiences I had with people. But I have a pretty interesting new set of jobs. Beside being an author with the new book, I'm teaching at Columbia. I'm on the faculty there, and I really enjoy my time there at Columbia. I enjoy the students. I enjoy the other faculty there. I really enjoyed my time at Georgia Tech. I was on the faculty of Georgia Tech when I was selected by NASA, and I thought, well, I always kind of thought in the back of my mind when my astronaut career was winding down, it'd be nice to go back to a university setting and share those experiences and work with students, and that's what I've been doing. And also I do some work. I'm on the staff at the Intrepid Sea Air and Space Museum here in New York City. So those are my two major jobs, I guess, my regular jobs that I do. So it gives me a chance to interact with young people at the Intrepid Museum, kind of young, kids of all ages, but a lot of younger kids, and then college age kids and above, grad students and faculty at Columbia. So it really is a wonderful way to go through life. And the book's been great. Every once in a while, an occasional TV appearance when it comes up, I enjoy doing that. And some speaking engagements as well, going around the country speaking. I'm headed out to Lisbon to a conference now. I'll be at this week, and looking forward to that. So it's been interesting. Not quite like flying in space, but it's only 2 years ago that I left NASA, and so far it's been a lot of fun.
Well, Mike, thanks so much for your time today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. It's really been a pleasure. It's been a great pleasure talking with you today. Thank you.
Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Check out podcasts of this and previous episodes on mynspr.org. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News and me at Dave Shlom and Mike Massimino at @astro_Mike. And while I always remind you that we live on a pale blue dot, let's go out with the right stuff. Nolan, all I have to say is this in my best Levon Helm voice. The interview was over, but on that glorious day in November 2016, Dave Shlom got to talk to a man with the right stuff, NASA astronaut Mike Massimino, the greatest space telescope repairer anyone had ever seen.